Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for February 8th, 2015. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And joining us once again on the Kudzu Vine from Arkansas, Mr. Drew Pritt. Welcome, Drew.
Greetings from now Razorback Red, Arkansas.
So. Okay. Well, yeah, Drew, good to have you back on. And anytime we have you on, you're able to talk about stuff really across the nation, across the South. But Arkansas being your home, that's your strong suit. And so I want to, you know, go to that at first. I don't think we've had you on since the election. And we know Arkansas, it was like every other southern state. It was tough for Democrats. But the fact that you had a popular multi-term incumbent Democrat and Mark Pryor, I think it may have been a little rougher. Also, you held the governor's mansion up until Election Day, and that changed hands. It wasn't just status quo like it was for many other states across the South, more of the same. Give us just your quick thought on what happened in Arkansas and why it happened, I mean, other than just the national wave.
You know, I mean, on the one hand, you have to say it was a national wave, but, I mean, I think it's this, is that Arkansas, more than any other southern state, had bucked the Republican tide ever since Richard Nixon started the Southern Strategy back in the 1960s. And, you know, we kind of like trying to drive a car till it runs out of gas. I think it shocked a lot of people, but it finally just ran out of gas unfortunately, we saw a lot of good Democrats go down this time. It's still a little bit of a shock. We've seen some Republicans win statewide, but we've never seen a loss on this scale. I mean, we lost. We had a narrow margin that was in the state house. It's going to be a one or two cycles before we ever get the state house back now. We saw the state Senate increase its majority. We saw, for the Republicans, we saw all seven constitutional offices for the first time in history go Republican, and our entire congressional delegation, both Senate seats and all four House seats, are Republican. And, you know, it's definitely a new day in Arkansas, but it was one that was kind of, I think, a shock on the scale that it did, especially the fact that Mark Pryor lost. I mean, I think it was very telling that Charlie Daniels, who was our Secretary of State, our land commissioner, our state auditor, and also I think had a term as state treasurer in there, Charlie actually always capitalized on the fact that he has a similar name as the famous musician Charlie Daniels, and the musician Charlie Daniels would come in and always do a fundraiser for him. And he's a little bit of a good old boy, you know, from South Arkansas. And Charlie, I think, was very telling, made the statement that he says, I do believe I would have probably lost had I been running for re-election. And this is a man who's never gone below 60% when he runs for re-election. So that should give you at least a little bit of a snippet of the scale of loss that happened to us in this state.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of state straight ticket party voting. Well, I know Catherine's probably got some questions too. The big one, now Arkansas is in a special situation, I think, from a lot of other southern states. Odds are the next time that we vote, the former First Lady of Arkansas will be the head of the Democratic Party. She'll be at the top of the ticket. Does that help fix things, or does she not have those Arkansas roots since she you know, ran and served from Senate, New York, and has lived in D.C. for, you know, either D.C. or New York for over two decades now?
I think in some ways it helps and in some way it hurts. It helps if we have female candidates on the ticket. That she has always drawn a very large base in the Democratic women in Arkansas, and I do believe that if she runs, it's going to strengthen the value of Democratic tickets that have female nominees on them. The downside to it is that you know, even when Hillary was the first lady of the state for many years, it was always understood that she was in Arkansas, but not of Arkansas, like Bill, that this was Bill's state. Bill threw a lot into this state. President Clinton threw a lot into this state in this last election. But unfortunately, some of the powers that be did not listen to the advice that he was giving. And I believe had they given more heed to what President Clinton was telling them, maybe we could have spent the time. Maybe not we could have spent the tide. Who knows? So that's one thing to take into consideration. Another thing that's very clear is that there has been a circling of wagons. I was talking recently with a former prominent state legislator who in 2008 served on a steering committee along with myself and a number of other people for Bill Richardson for president, and we were the Arkansas steering committee, and Bill Richardson had a pretty prominent slate, and this legislator has been spending quite a time since doing mea culpa with those who are tied with the Clinton organization for having not supported the First Lady this time. So there's kind of like a fear within the state to not step out of line and to back somebody else. I mean, there's a few people that Joe Maverick, I've never been known as an insider. You know, I mean, I love the idea of Martin O'Malley. You know, I've spoken with some of Jim Webb's people. They're actually active in this state. Which is interesting, that he's got some people down here already working for him. But outside of that, I think this is definitely going to be I just would say it's a wash. It hurts and it helps to have Hillary at the top of the ticket for Arkansas.
Okay. Catherine, questions for Drew on Arkansas before we move on to anything else?
I don't have any specific questions on Arkansas, but I know you have some more, so go ahead.
Well, there was one thing, Drew, you kind of alluded to some happenings post-election and some of the things we know that are more ready to share than others, so we don't want to give away anything you might have let us know about. So you tell us what's happened post-election in Arkansas that you feel the listeners should know about.
I think there's been three very unique things that have happened in the state. First of all, I never thought the day would come when I would say this, but I'm very pleased with our new governor, Asa Hutchinson. He is kind of, in his short time that he's been in office, he's almost like Mike Beebe Light. He's not gone fundamentalist. He's kind of kept the Tea Partiers at bay. He's already exerted a lot of strength in making sure that the Arkansas private option was extended for two more years, and that passed by 80-12 in the legislature. What the private option is that Arkansas became a new model for expansion of the Obamacare law when it started the private option. It's been sold as a free market alternative, but basically the private option is kind of like a hybrid between the Affordable Care Act, the aims of that, while at the same time allowing your option of who you're going to choose rather than the health insurance exchange. Under the private option, individuals in Arkansas below 138% of the federal poverty line, which would be $32,000 for a family of four, receive a subsidy to purchase insurance. Anybody above that avoids the penalty that they've put out there and is able to keep their doctor as long as that they register for that doctor through the health exchange itself. Proponents of the plan, you know, say that how it's free for the state of Arkansas because we're able to get 100% of that money that comes from the federal government, but the fact that we're able to kind of like pick and choose what we want. The Congressional Budget Office, for instance, pointed out that the private insurance costs 50% more for recipients than Medicaid, and so they were able to, like, somehow get it to where there's even a subsidy for the doctors themselves. It's such a good plan that Kentucky and Virginia have now started to model their ideas off of us. And so it was very interesting that, you know, the Republicans were just, you know, just rabid about Obamacare. Let's end Obamacare. And here in one state where it was probably a bigger red wave than most, their first major act is to extend Obamacare for another 2 years under the guise of the private option. That's a big deal. Second big deal is really caused a large controversy is that the State Board of Education has come in and has taken over the Little Rock School District. They had 6 out of its 38 schools were listed in academic distress. You always hear about schools with the academic distress. The thing has been for the last 3 years, the Little Rock School Board made some national news because it became the first majority African-American controlled school board in the Deep South for a major city. The Chamber of Commerce has really put a lot of pressure on them. There's been a lot of fighting. There was a superintendent they brought in named Dexter Suggs. Suggs ended up becoming a turncoat, kind of like a Benedict Arnold, and turned against the board and worked with the and appealed directly to the State Board of Education. And so we need to be taken over. There was a big fight. There was hearings. And by a very narrow 5-4 vote, where a liberal legislator who at one time they thought had statewide aspirations, a gentleman by the name of Sam Ledbetter, he cast a deciding vote and went against public education and supported the chamber and the idea of vouchers and the idea of charter schools coming in. So that has really caused a huge uproar, to say the least, here in Little Rock. And the final big news is that our nominee for state auditor this last go-around, a woman by the name of Regina Stewart Hampton, she kind of burst onto the scene. Nobody really knew who she was at first. Her husband was the very first African-American to run statewide. He ran for governor in 1970. Regina kind of ran a little bit separate from the party and kind of like, you know, kind of, you know, didn't run against the party, but kind of ran her own game. And because she was down ballot, the party didn't really start to take notice of her until the polling showed she was doing a lot better, even sometimes better than Mark Pryor. Tried to utilize that in the closing days. Anyways, long story short is that she's exploring a bid now for U.S. Congress in the 2nd Congressional District. The big news is if she wins, she'll become the first African-American female in the Deep South to win a House seat in the old Confederacy. It should be noted she did lose to the Republican nominee who was state legislator, but she outraised the state legislator by 2-1, and she got 49% in the 2nd Congressional District, which is significant because she did well in rural boxes than some of the traditional Democrats did, and this is an African-American female doing that. So, you know, Does it translate into a successful congressional race? Time will tell. She did have Danny Davis, congressman from Illinois, had a number of members of Congressional Black Caucus come in, fundraiser for her last time. There's indications they will do so again. She may be part of the future of the Democratic Party's resurgence in Arkansas. The only other thing is that it's a waiting game now between three men. The word is that former general or retired general Wesley Clark, former governor Mike Beebe, and former FEMA director James Lee Witt are the top three who are looking at the U.S. Senate seat against Bozeman. Bozeman, most recently with the FEC count, only had 85,000 in his account. I think he's more worried about a Tea Party challenge. But if any one of those three, Clark, Witt, or Beebe gets in, Bozeman could immediately go to the vulnerable list, and potentially that would be a Senate seat that would go down. Obviously, everybody wants Beebe to run simply because he's never lost. Clark has got a national base to pull from, and the fact he's got that military record. The thing with Clark is he just turned 70 years old. But Witt is a year older than him, has a new wife who's in her late 20s. He was a widower. He did decent in his race for Congress, held the Republican to under 50%. There was a third-party candidate in that race. And, you know, the word is that, you know, and Witt can self-fund a race. So that may actually, between the Senate race and that congressional race, that may put Arkansas back in the blue in 2 years. We'll just have to wait and see.
Well, it sounds like candidate recruitment is not as bad an issue with some of those candidates that you're talking about, because a lot of them even have national profiles. Certainly no problem with statewide profiles. Well, let's go ahead, and that's a great job on covering Arkansas, and let's kind of move to some other states. And first one that just jumped out at me is they almost tie together. We're going to talk about the kind of, in some ways, more comical one. The other one's not at all comical, but there is a new senator from North Carolina, Tom Tillis, who, you know, defeated Kay Hagan. That was kind of a surprise, and you would think that he'd understand North Carolina is not the deepest of red states. You have to kind of, you know, kind of be a little smarter about your politics. And one of the first times he makes national news as a U.S. senator, he says that he thinks that restaurants should not be required to make their employees wash their hands. Basically, he is coming out against mandated hand washing. Now, I know this is kind of one of those extreme, more libertarian points of view. Don't tell business what to do. I've heard it in other quarters, like, you know, people saying, well, oh, well, Lester Maddox, when he had the Pickrick Grill and he didn't want to serve African Americans, it was his business. He should be able to do that. And I wouldn't do it my business, but, you know, he had the business right. I mean, it's kind of that same type old thing, except it's hand washing, which unsanitary, I mean, to say the least. Catherine, what in the world is Tom Tillis thinking? Even really thinking this or saying this, even if he does think this?
Well, that's the thing. It's the saying it that is so ridiculous. The idea that, you know, the requirement that employees wash their hands is some type of burden on businesses, it's ridiculous. I mean, and didn't he say something about the market will, you know, let the market decide? Okay, so are people then going to, like, post in their restaurants, our employees wash their hands?
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. You know,
well,
it's all part of this, you know, anti-science, you know, it's all part of the same sort of conversation about vaccines and climate change and then you know, let the market control, let the market determine these things. I just it's a huge disappointment for me that elected officials, you know, from, you know, county commissioners to U.S. senators are wasting time talking about these things when there's so many important needs that are going unmet in our country. It's just, I mean, it's funny, but it's very disappointing. It's when you think about it.
Well, I mean, to me, it brings up a bigger issue. Okay, you know that restaurants, that they have to get these food service ratings, and, you know, they look at all kind of things, and washing hands is part of that food service rating. Now, if you believe, like Tom Tillis did, the market would cover it and work everything out, would you not be then for just getting rid of these food ratings and, you know, basically, well, you know, if people start to get food poisoning enough times, then, you know, your restaurant will go out of business. But then, of course, everybody's got to get food poisoning to get there. Or this, you know, the old meat. I mean, hey, maybe we can get by with serving old meat if we cook it long enough, you know, and nobody knows, and but the market, we can hide it from the market. I mean, to me, it all fits in together with this. And then there's the political part. He didn't win that race overwhelmingly. I think in any other year he would lose. I wonder how many voters, swing voters, maybe particularly swing females, that, you know, mothers that getting their little, you know, boys to wash their hands and keeping on them, are just appalled by this and would have stayed with Kay Hagan had they known how he felt about, you know, something as simple as hand washing. Drew, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think you have to look in, you know, that old saying, consider the source. I mean, Tom Tillis is a product of business. If you just look at a quick, and what I did was I always like to see where they come from, so to speak, is the best way to say it. And so I looked to see what his background was. And, you know, Tillis started out with Wang Laboratories. From there, he was with Price Waterhouse. From there, you know, he before he got into politics, he was in big business. And then from there, if you look at what some of his accomplishments are, you know, he likes to point out the fact that they restructured the state's business tax code, the fact that there was a reduction of business income taxes, elimination of the estate tax, a cap on gasoline tax, sunset existing state rules and regulations, and limit new regulations to a 10-year duration. That's just a little taste from his website about what he wants people to know about him. So, I mean, I'd say this type of support right here is par for the course. Kay Hagan, you know, narrowly lost that race. I mean, I don't think people realize it was less than 40,000 votes out of almost 3 million votes that separated her with Tom Tillis. And, you know, there was, you know, 5,000 votes, just scanning the votes right there, that went for write-ins, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a little bit of buyer's remorse, I guess, is what you're getting at right there, that people, you know, did this. But I don't see Tom Tillis as really – I think the other thing, too, is – Tom Tillis is very much an insider who latched on to the Tea Party to try to get the votes to get in there. And this may just be kind of like him throwing them some red meat so they won't primary him in 5 more years. That's my
guess. Yeah, I would think even Tea Party people might want people to wash their hands. It's just crazy. Maybe he owns stock in like a salad. I don't know. What I wonder what kind of business, you know, requires. I'm talking about restaurant business requires the food service workers not to touch the food. I was fixing to say salad bar, but even that gets put out. I just don't know. Maybe he owns a grocery store and he wants somebody to cook at home. But then, of course, you could have your butchers at Kroger or A&P or wherever. They wouldn't have to wash their hands before they cut the meat. I just keep taking this on and on. But, Catherine, you alluded to another point that I think I kind of made in the show notes. And another issue came up that was science-related, vaccines. And this has gotten into the Republican primary for president and different candidates have had different takes on vaccines. You know, Rand Paul, I think he said, well, he's not in favor of making anybody vaccinate their children, but he is pro-vaccine and had a photo op where he was getting vaccinated for something, I guess, you know, 45, 50-year-olds need to get vaccinated for. Usually we're talking about, you know, 6 and 10-year-old kids instead. And then I think Ben Carson, who's a surgeon, who's become big in the Tea Party, he came out as pro-vaccination as far as, like, getting vaccinated. But nobody wants to tell that, really, that hardcore sliver of probably no more than, say, 10% of the population tops that is anti-vaccination. And a lot of this, which kind of surprised me, it really, I don't think all this anti-vaccination comes out of GOP politics. It comes out of this just really kind of almost smothers, if you will, that fear, you know, maybe autism comes from this. I think there was a Jenny McCarthy who, what I would not think would be a paragon of Republican ideals. She's apparently anti-vaccination. And I don't know why, you know, some Republicans have latched onto this crowd, but they have, but it then recurs into that same theme of the Republicans' war on science. Catherine, what have you been hearing about this, and how do you think it's going to affect their chances?
Well, I think it makes them look, it makes them look like they're pandering, first of all, to this small, like you said, I don't think it's 10%. I think it's much smaller than that. The sliver of the population that is, you know, crying out vaccination requirements. But the funny or the interesting, it's not really funny. I mean, this is very serious business. Chris Christie came out, and he and Bobby Jindal both said something like, you know, people should be given the choice, and, you know, which just sort of cracked me up that they're talking about choice when it comes to vaccines, but that's a whole other story. But then they both rolled back, you know, as soon as they started getting criticized, they both rolled back and said, well, you know, I think people should get vaccinations, but you know, parents should have the right to raise their children however they want, but, you know, vaccinations are important, you know, it's just pandering. You know, so now someone who is anti-vaccination can say, well, I like Chris Christie because he spoke his mind, but then he was, you know, derided by the public, and so he changed his stance. I don't know. I'm just amazed that it's actually a conversation, that we're actually talking about not vaccinating our children for measles, mumps, and rubella. I mean, it's just amazing that...
Mark my words, within probably... Catherine, I'm willing to bet within 6 months we're going to be talking about the fluoridization of the water, that old John Birch
issue.
And they're going to bring that back, that's the government getting in your business as well as fluoridizing your water. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You're right. But it's also scary.
It is scary.
The folks that don't want fluoride in their water or any other government product, dig a well. You know, just get your well.
If you don't want to get your kids vaccinated, keep them at home.
Well,
right.
And Catherine, you say that, but I have a sneaking feeling, and this is where it gets into the GOP political side of this thing, is I bet a lot of the anti-vaccination crowd are also homeschoolers, which the homeschool politics is tied pretty closely into the GOP, because that's where you would get, even if the population of anti-vaccinators is 4%, 7%, you know, whatever it is. I don't know what it is. It is probably under 10. That crowd is probably some of the most loyal, you know, Republican voters. I bet they're big in the Iowa caucuses. Because otherwise, why would, you know, so many who have to be intelligent Republicans who have vaccinated their kids are vaccinated themselves, because the MMR shot's been around for decades. I'm pretty sure all three of us got that vaccination.
Oh, yeah.
And so they can't believe this, and so why they have to be pandering for this, because they're afraid in that little small universe, it can hurt them. Because in a general election, that crowd, there's nowhere for them to go anyway. Because obviously I doubt Hillary Clinton's going to be their anti-vaccination.
Oh, no, she already came out and was like, you know, she came out, she did a, said a really good thing, you know, vaccine, I can't remember what she said, but it was really strong. It was like about vaccinations, climate change, and science all in one statement. It was really good.
Yeah.
It was concise.
I guess if you could somehow say, look, I guess if you can walk far enough on the flat earth, maybe you can find a place to walk away from the measles. You know, because it kind of gets into that same, you know, thought. And it's just climate change is big. It seems like the stem cell research ties into this. All these different things that are scientific breakthroughs. There's a certain sliver of the Republican Party that comes out against it and then moves the rest of the party, which is probably not afraid of science necessarily, to the right with them.
I just want to say something here. It's not all, you know, like what we call, you know, Republican conservatives who are anti-vaccination. There's also a group that is, you know, more progressive that are sort of the, you know, they're like the anti-GMOs, the anti, you know, the organic food folks that. Also are against vaccines. It's not just this.
Yeah.
I just don't want to put them all in the same category. It's a range of political, a range on the political spectrum. You know, people who tend to be more progressive on maybe some other social issues, but don't believe in, you know, what they say is poisoning their children with these vaccines. So I just wanted to make that clear that it's not just the, you know, wackadoodle.
Right, and it's a good indication there, but I think going back to something David said right there, David, and maybe we'll get to this about some developments we've seen in other races, but I think here's the thing. The fact is that the Republicans pandering to that, as Catherine said, great, right now, the wackadoodle, you know, fringe that you have there. What you're doing now is you're chasing good Republicans. I mean, not just Rockefeller Republicans, but hell, Goldwater Republicans out of the party and chasing them into the Democratic Party, because it's gotten crazy at this point.
The reaction, you know, by any elected official, anyone who wants to be a leader, should be, don't be ridiculous. Of course we vaccinate our children. Right. That
right.
should be the reaction from anyone who hopes to be a leader in this country. To the idea that you would, you know, would give any kind of credence to this practice is just, it's shocking.
But it's shocking to me that we would actually debate and argue over whether having a healthy life is socialism or whether.
Of course, yes.
You know? I mean, I'm still in shock that the healthcare crisis caused that much of a fight, you know, so. But that's just me, you know.
And you're right about the far left, if you will, too. Kind of the folks that are probably, you know, there's probably a lot of folks that voted for Ralph Nader instead of Al Gore in 2000. And I don't think the Democratic Party should, you know, pander to that fringe either, and I don't think we do. As much, and that's good, because then we'd be anti-vaccination on the other end, which would be, you know, more defensible. Well, let's continue to move through some topics, and one that kind of grabbed me was in Florida, Marco Rubio, he's still looking at the idea of running for president, but if he does or he doesn't, that Senate seat is really, he hasn't locked that thing down. I mean, Florida's a swing state. I don't think he's become this, you know, 800-pound political gorilla that can't be defeated. And so Alan Grayson, who I think is one of the more fascinating politicians in America, has said he's looking to that seat. He's a good fundraiser. He's a pretty dynamic guy. He's kind of interesting. He's pretty liberal, but then doesn't fit the he's still wanting to get in your face with, you know, about it in a more of a, you know, tough way, if you will. And so I think he's an interesting candidate. Catherine, if he runs, or when do you think he'll run, and if he runs, what do you think his chances are for that Florida Senate seat?
Well, it sounds like he's, you know, interested in running, but he's not going to run if Debbie Wasserman Schultz decides to run, which I appreciate. I think primaries can be good, but they can also be very expensive, and they can, you know, run the brand down a little bit. You know, I think he might have a good chance. You know, he's very outspoken, and he's, you know, he's the kind of candidate that we all want, you know, who's like going to speak out and say what we want him to say, and maybe inspire some, you know, people who don't vote to come out and vote for him, and, you know, make the, I think he would certainly make the Senate race in Florida an interesting thing to watch and get some attention. So I would like it if he ran, but I don't want him to run against Debbie Wasserman Schultz. If they need to pick one of them, one or the other.
Yeah, that would be a pretty tough primary. Drew, what's your thoughts on Alan Grayson as a candidate?
I'm actually opposite of you, Catherine. I really just Alan Grayson speaks, and I just roll my eyes. I really don't think he is a. I'm not on the Alan Grayson fan boat personally. I want to see us win. I mean, you know, I don't think Alan Grayson can win a statewide race. And trust me, I've been with many. I mean, whether it's been my life in my races I've run, or you know, stuff I've been with those type of candidates that just they have a statement to make. But honestly, I'm not. You know, I think Alan Grayson is for the Democrats what's his face, Alan West is to the Republican Party down there. They're just the two bookends of the party. I'm more interested in people like Gwen Graham, Patrick Murphy. One name that is kind of underneath the undercurrent, but somebody who can definitely almost self-fund, and I think potentially could switch that seat, is Bud Childs, who is the son of Lalton Childs and who is the first cousin to Kay Hagan. And Bud is interested in that race. I think any one of those three right there could win statewide. I'm not that impressed with Grayson. I don't see yet that he could win a statewide race. Yes, he's raised $3 to $6 million, but you know that's pennies, you know, for a Senate race. You know, and that's just where I come down to it. I don't think he's a bad guy. I like what he has to say personally. Of course, I'm a liberal, so I would. But, you know, I don't think he can win statewide, so I'm just not that impressed. So that's where I come down on that.
Yeah, I agree with you on the I want to win, because obviously you got to win the seat to have the votes in the Senate, and that's one we've kind of – there's some places we've kind of got to get if we're going to retake the majority, and that's probably one of those seats that have to. And then also, it seems like lately Senate races have become so nationalized. If you get the nomination and that seat's in play, the money's going to come from somewhere. If you're on the Republican side, it's the Koch brothers. If you're on the Democratic side, there's going to be other interest groups that are going to make sure you have the nickels to rub together. Now, getting the fundraising for the primary is another matter. But then, of course, that's where your own personal fundraising comes in.
By the way, I want to say that Debbie Wasserman Schultz would be awesome. I didn't even know that she really was serious about the race. So, I mean, if she runs, I think she clears the field. I just want that said publicly. But, you know, I didn't know that she was that serious about it. But, you know, if she is, I mean, and I say this kind of in jest, but kind of in real life, you know, all hail Debbie. and let her have a shot, you know, so just just want to say that.
Yeah, obviously she's built up a lot of power in the House, and she'd have to risk that. So the polling would have to be pretty strong for to take
exactly.
that risk. But then speaking of polling, there was a poll that was put out asking Floridians, do you want Marco Rubio to run for president? 15% of Florida voters want him to run for president, and maybe that's partly because they like Jeb Bush better. Maybe they just don't want a Floridian or that Floridian to run. But then 57% said they would prefer he run for reelection, which, I mean, that might mean that he actually could get a good share of that 57, even that 15, if you add those together, that's 72% saying they guess they want him to run for something. And so it'll be interesting to see if those numbers, you know, hold up for him being that strong. That's going to be one of those states when polls start to get put in the field. What do they say? And we'll have to watch that. Staying in Florida, and this is kind of a current candidate but a past story. Back in 2006, the NFL was looking at naming a new commissioner. They named Roger Goodell to replace Paul Tagliabue. Apparently, Jeb Bush was approached about the job and thought about it and decided not to. Obviously, that's all the commissioner jobs are pretty controversial and usually underappreciated, because you kind of like the assistant principal at a school. You have to hand out discipline, and not everybody's going to agree with you all the time. And so maybe he thought if he took that job, he might tarnish his name, his image, what have you. But he did think about it. Catherine, were you surprised that the NFL looked at Jeb Bush, which it really has no football background that I know of, for the commissionership?
Well, just imagine how heartbreaking that would have been for his brother, who all he really ever wanted in life was to be the baseball commissioner, and his brother would be the football commissioner or whatever. I don't know. You know, I'm not
That's a good
sports
point.
Ball person. I don't pay any attention to sports, but...
But you made a great sports point, Catherine. I mean, that was about the brother, and that's what he wanted to do, was be in baseball. So, kind of ironic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Drew, what's your thoughts on this?
You know, I just have to think that with Jeb Bush, I think it was at that point, let's see, 2006 is when this was, you know, was the chance that Jeb Bush ever was going to get a chance to run for president? Probably not. You know, I think more of it, of the case that the reason that they just maybe offered it to him was because, you know, the family does have a lot of influence and power out there, and you know, they need to find something maybe for poor Jeb. I just kind of feel like Jeb is just kind of like the I don't know. He's the sad chapter of the Bush family, and that says a lot right now considering who he has to match with. But I think it's a sad chapter for them. It's like, did they ever think he'd have a chance to run for president? Probably not. So this was kind of like, you know, you won't get to run for president, but here's your parting prize, maybe. I think it's crazy that he would have been offered. I would believe George W. Bush would be a better baseball commissioner than Jeb Bush, NFL commissioner, but stranger things have happened. So.
Yeah, and now, of course, I wouldn't be surprised at all if, I guess, George W. Bush is running some major art gallery, because he seems to be more into his painting than he is baseball these days. But... You know, so people evolve, I guess. Well, let's continue and talk about evolution in a different way. For seemingly, you know, 6 years now at least, the Republican Party has been the party of no. Any idea the Democrats come up with, it's no. And we've had more of the power because we've had the Senate, we've had the presidency, they had the House, but there was still we're more of a position to do things. And the Republicans would just try to, you know, repeal things or no.
and all that. Well, now the Republicans have the House and Senate, and so they can put together more legislation than they have in the past. And so the New York Times asked this past week, have the Democrats become the party of no, because it may be where they pass bills now through the House and the Senate, and either the Democrats can try to filibuster in the Senate or the president can veto it, which are negative no's, if you will. Now, of course, we just talked about vaccinations, and we say yes, and they say no. So I don't know that it's been truly a fit. But, Catherine, are we at risk of becoming the party of no, and what would that mean politically if we're seen that way?
I don't think we're at that risk, I think, but I do think that we will say no when things are when it's not the right thing for the country. I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think we'll be the party of no like the Republicans have been. I'm not worried about that.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of times what it is can you put forth legislation? Now, we can put forth legislation. It can never be brought up, but we say, hey, we have a plan. At times, Republicans didn't even have plans for certain things. It was just, we don't like that. But
we don't like that because it's the Democrats' idea.
And there would be
silence. I don't think we're at risk of that.
Yeah, so if we stop putting forth ideas, then there's more risk at that. Drew, what do you think on this party of no?
I think there can continue to be the party of no. I really have not. I mean, you've got Mitch McConnell as their leader and John Boehner. I mean, I think that's enough to just say no right there. Where did the phrase just say no come from? But from a Republican first lady. Nancy Reagan. I don't think that there has been enough, though, in all seriousness, I don't think there has been enough time of us being Democrats being in the wilderness for us to become the party of no. Republicans started becoming the party of no after they had gone decades and cycle after cycle of just getting just clobbered at the polls. And so that's pretty much just a natural reaction. We've taken a hit, but we've not become a party of no yet, I do not believe.
Well, and we have the bully pulpit. And so that, you know, the president can have a State of the Union, and I've even for either party, I've yet to see a State of the Union in which it's, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this.
Right.
There's always plans either way, because that's what the State of the Union is where you share your vision, you have new ideas. And so that would have to be the next step. And like we've said, trends are not looking like we will lose that because of how the Electoral College, among other things, is constructed. So we'll continue to monitor this situation, but until the people, you know, take hold of that idea, that's another thing. Perception is everything a lot of times in politics as well. Well, let's talk about some polling, and there was a new poll from Brock McCleary at Harper Polling. We've had Brock on the show a handful of times. He kind of started his firm trying to be the Republicans' answer to public policy polling. And by the way, next week on the show, if you haven't looked at the feed, Tom Jensen's going to be on the show next week with us as our guest to talk about some of his new polls. And we like to have Brock on sometimes too, but he just released a Kentucky governor's race poll. And if you look at the states in the South that are going to have, you know, some good races, Kentucky's certainly one of them. And good graphics on this poll. Right off the bat, it's interesting. 50% of Kentuckians say that Kentucky's on the right track, 38% say it's on the wrong track. Kentucky has a Democratic president, which, of course, presidency matters in politics these days more than it ever has because everything's nationalized. Kentuckians also have a Democratic governor. So you would think, well, Democrats are in pretty good shape. They got a 12-point lead on right track, wrong track. But then if you begin to pull down into the general numbers, the most likely candidate, the Attorney General Jack Conway, is slightly behind most of the Republicans he's matched up against. I guess Comer, who's I guess seen as the front runner, James Comer. Actually, Jack. He has Jack Conway's 4 points down to him. He's 2 points down to Hal Heiner, and actually has a lead on Matt Blevin, although I think Matt Blevin's kind of a fringe candidate from what I understand about Kentucky politics. Catherine, do those two things mesh, the right track, wrong track, and Jack Conway's numbers?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, they have a whole bunch, there's a whole bunch of potential Republican candidates, and not, it doesn't sound like anybody's running against there's one person, right, running against Jack Conway. So,
but there's no serious candidate now that Allison Leonard Grimes seemingly is going to run for re-election.
Right. So I think that's good for him, gives him a chance, you know, during the primaries to, you know, solidify his platform and all that. Reading that poll, I thought it was good news for Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly going to be a race. There's no doubt about that. Drew, looking at this poll and those top line issues, what were your thoughts?
First of all, I think I agree with Catherine that this is actually good numbers for us right here. You know, Kentucky, I know a little bit about it, and being so close to West Virginia, where my family was real active politically. In fact, had a governor, incidentally, off top real quick, Kentucky governor, Brereton Jones, who actually used to sit next to my cousin in the state legislature. He was a West Virginia state legislator, and they moved next door and did that. Jack Conway, this for him, this is what you would call a race of redemption. You know, he's lost two major races. He burst onto the scene when he ran for Congress back in 2002, ran against Ann Northup, you know, got some national money in the Kentucky 3rd Congressional District. You know, really, it suddenly put Kentucky on the map. He nearly lost to her, came back, got elected to the, you know, Attorney General's race, real good. Then he runs for U.S. Senate in 2010. And lost to Rand Paul. And so that was actually a race that many people thought Conway was going to win. You know, the governor that you have right now, Steve Beshears, great guy, but he's more like Mike Beebe. He's a moderate Democrat. You know, Jack Conway is very much liberal on many issues. You know, he says he's fiscally conservative, and, you know, maybe that's true that, you know, he is a big supporter of Second Amendment rights. But outside of that, he's pretty progressive, you know, on labor issues, Medicare and Social Security, you know, the right to choose for a woman, right to choose, you know, even on gay marriage, very liberal. So I think that's the one thing you have to look at that's maybe affecting it. The other thing that I would take into consideration is that they've not really gotten going yet on the Republican side, but Mark Blevins is not, or Blevins is not exactly a fringe candidate as much as, or not Mark, but Matt, pardon me, not so much a fringe candidate as much as, you know, he is a Tea Party darling. And as a result, that's going to hurt Comer, because Comer is really banking heavy on his support with the Tea Party. So I think as he and Matt Blevins get into it and they start debating and stuff like this, what they're going to do is they're going to kind of like cancel each other out. And I think at that point you see somebody like, one of the other candidates maybe slip in. It's going to be a nasty primary for the Republicans. Meanwhile, Conway is able to bank his money. And if he's starting out at those numbers, if you look at his base, if he's starting right there as his base with that, it's not inconceivable that should Comer go in, you know, wounded because of Bevin, or if Bevin gets the nomination, either one of them, you know, Conway gets a large Republican support right there. The other thing is if Hal Heiner gets in there. You know, he was a city councilman from Louisville, you know, he ironically picked as his running mate the state treasurer nominee, who's from Lexington. And anybody knows anything about Kentucky knows that rivalry between Louisville and Lexington, and two ends of the state right there. You know, so at that point, Heiner goes in. I think, you know, it still benefits Conway. The candidate that I'm very interested in is Will Scott. Reason why is Will Scott had run for Congress a few times back in the 80s, but he was the state Supreme Court Chief Justice, and he was a Vietnam War veteran. Scott didn't get into this race because he wanted to run. Scott was drafted into this race. And he's very much that kind of courthouse crowd type candidate. That would be the Republican that I would be scared of out of those four right there for Conway. Otherwise, I think Conway beats Bevin, Comer, or Heiner. But Scott is the one I would be most worried about.
Yeah, and I think the candidates are going to be interesting. Another thing that I did notice that I liked about this poll, kudos to Brock, is he looked at the top issues and he broke it down by party. And both Democrats and Republicans, jobs and the economy, exactly at 44%. And by and large, the numbers were very similar. The biggest divide was Democrats, I think, education and school was 19%. For Republicans, it was 11%. And
yeah.
Taxes and tax reform and spending and debt issues was 12% for Democrats and 19% for Republicans. Also, I think Democrats were a little more onto about percentage point, really not much, onto bridges and roads. And so other than just a few more people being interested in taxes on the Republican Party, a few more folks on education for Democrats, the people kind of saw the same issues, which I think that's a good sign, because at least if you're concerned with the same issues, no matter which party, you can at least say this is what we ought to solve. When you don't even see the problems as the same, you know, it's hard to work on. It's kind of like climate change. So many Republicans are not – that's not even on their radar. It's hard to discuss it with them. But at least, you know, there's so many things that they can find common ground to discuss and debate. Well, Drew, we sure appreciate you being on. If there's anything going on in Arkansas that you'd like to share in the next 2 minutes before we close this thing out, take that time.
If you'll give me I'm begging liberty right here, I'd like to just mention Mississippi real quick.
Quickly, so, I know we didn't get to it among other topics, and of course that's how it always goes on the Kudzu Vine. We overplan because we don't want to have dead air at the end.
Well, that's fine. Well, listen, filing deadline's March 1st there. Mississippi has had something very interesting. A former Republican state senator and county supervisor switched to the Democratic Party. Now, it's interesting to see the Republicans switching back, but he switched to the Democratic Party to run for lieutenant governor. The lieutenant governor there, Tate Reeves, is just hated by Chris McDaniel, who lost that tight U.S. Senate race down there last year. It's going to be very interesting. There's a few other big names talking about running for governor, either Travis Childers, the former congressman and U.S. Senate nominee, or potentially Jim Hood, the attorney general, who, you know, he just never seems to lose, no matter how much Republicans try, or former Governor Ray Mabus. It would be interesting to see if Mississippi starts to at least shade from deep red to maybe a pink or a purplish hue, kind of like how Virginia did. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. But I think the fact that you see a more moderate Republican switching to the – and the reason why he did is because he does not like the Republican stance on Obamacare, which is a very interesting stance for a Republican to take, or now a Democrat, you know, but a former Republican to take in the Deep South. So that's going to be a very interesting state to watch.
Yeah, I think that issue's creeping up all over. My state senator here in Georgia, a big Republican, Chuck Hufstetler, last year
kind of said, I mean, he didn't come out pro-Obamacare by any means, but he kind of said he thought the Republicans were too harsh on trying to limit health care choices, and so came kind of moderated on that. So maybe we're going to see more Republicans come to their senses, and that's going to be something to watch, all that Mississippi. And I apologize we didn't get to that any deeper, but there's just a lot of good topics this week. Well, before I close out again, next week, Tom Jensen will be our special guest, and the plan is looking like Catherine and I will be joined by a old friend of the show. We'll talk more about that when we get to it next Sunday on the Kudzu Vine. Catherine?
Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks again, Drew. Night.